I'll read you a story from a book that won't be out until May called Magnificent Bastards. So in this new age of temperance, it might be changed to Magnificent Bar Stools. That's my thing. Oh, thanks. All right. Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. I'm American, so I'm sorry for everything. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Great. Okay. What is this? Am I being broadcast over the internet? Oh, thank God. Because this is going to suck. Okay. This story is called Impact. Pete Graham wants to impact. He's just started up his own ad agency, Snakebite. Snakebite has landed its first account, a small European supplier of fish fingers. I'm sat with the client, Pete is saying. The client says to me, Pete, I have a modest budget. I say, no, modest won't do. You'll take me on because you want to impact. Pete is a big ruddy fellow with a face full of broken capillaries, always dressed for some wonderful idea from the night before that he can't seem to remember. He's got that kind of enthusiasm that makes you think of an aerobics instructor. I can see the client is clueless, he continues. I indicate beyond the office glass to the plant. I say to him, what do you see out there? He says, fish fingers. What do you see? I tell him I see perch modules teetering along tracks, speeding through various processes of automation, a humming, tinkling corral of perfectly flaked and cubed fish product. And I tell the client, I'm sorry, I cannot sell that any more than I can describe the color red to a blind man. What I can sell, I tell him, what I can sell is tasty, fresh, convenient. These are things you cannot touch. I can sell the fish finger experience. What a load of shit, I say. Of course, that's advertising, says Pete. And I say, but you got the account. He says, indeed I did. He catches the barman's eye and signals for another round. I'm pretty sure he's half in the bag now. He tells me he's got 200 square meters of open plan space in Charlotte Street. Zinc work tables, a shit-hot graphics team, 24 employees. What I do not have, he sighs, is unity. Unity? Employee unity. A sense of teamwork, the gestalt of the competitive landscape. Well, it's early days yet, I replied. Early days. Did I just say that? Lately, these Briticisms have been creeping into my vernacular. Filthy day, at the end of the day. British forward thinking ends at sundown. They just want to get through the day so they can start drinking. But then, come to think of it, so do I. Pete stares up at a stuffed exhibit in the corner of the pub, a moth-eaten badger poised mid-pounce over dilapidated grouse. When he looks, gazes back down at me, it's with the same look as the badger, a look that effectively traps me. I want you to teach them softball, he says. Softball. So this is what he's invited me here for. He says, I've entered Snakebite into the ad league. I've never coached softball, I say. Yes, but you play it, he says. But that doesn't mean I want to win the league, he says. Worst to first. That sort of thing. I think that would congeal us into a workforce. I expect you can work wonders. Now, Ad League is where I first met Pete. His former agency had a team, and he'd inducted me as a ringer. These are very jovial, unstately gatherings, basically just an excuse to drink beer. No one except me really seemed to want to take it seriously, and once, after single-handedly turning a triple play and getting nothing more than a perfunctory cheers for that from a teammate, I decided to stop playing. Pete reaches down and retrieves a large cardboard box, which he sets onto the table, a gross of t-shirts. This gets our name out there, he says, holding one up against the late afternoon light. The shirts are a lurid red with a coiled rattlesnake on the front. What do you think, he says. I ask, can any of your employees play softball? None of them have the first clue, he answers, then adds somewhat mysteriously, but Sanjeev in accounts is a Bengali. Meaning, I imagine, he's a keen cricketer. That's a start. Cricket isn't softball, I say. Nonsense, he says. It's like the difference between hair and fur. He hands me a sheet of paper. He says, these are the league tables. I say, schedule, Pete, not tables. It's called a schedule. All right, whatever you say. Anyway, your first match is next Wednesday. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to make it to Hertfordshire in 45 minutes if there's any chance of nailing my wife. Pete leaves me with the t-shirts, and just like that, he's off to impact on his wife. Now, I have observed professional baseball players and coaches my whole life. They're unsmiling men, full of small, dismissive gestures, alternately expectorating viscous liquids or scratching their genitalia. They take the game seriously. It is this taciturn approach that I will use to shape Pete's team into a winning unit. The following day, I have a hangover like nobody's business. We assemble for our first practice in Regent's Park at the footbridge in the shadow of the Great Mosque. The park has a quality that makes it seem endless and tightly manicured at the same time. In the distance, the BT Tower dominates the horizon. It is a hideous-looking thing, a bedpost covered in bottle caps. Overhead, low-rumbling airbuses compete for the ruination of the British skyline. Such splendor seems lost on the snake biters. Seven guys, four girls, all looking irked and vaguely listless, like they've been forced to attend mandatory CPR training. Various introductions are curtly exchanged, and I have a chance to assess the components. There is a Julius, a Barnaby, a Hamish, a Humphrey, a Rayner, a Sanjeev, a Roderick, there is a Hermione, and two Fays. These are not names remotely associated with athleticism. I need guys named Whitey, Deke, or Chipper to win at softball. Frankly, it's dispiriting. Three of the guys have clearly arrived straight from work. One is wearing a suit and dress shoes. Of the four girls, only one, a tall, pretty brunette, Sam, looks fit, but she is at that very moment constructing a giant spliff. The other three try to look invisible, their faces suggesting impending flight. Sanjeev, from accounts, is in cricket whites. There were supposed to be 14 players, Humphrey explains, but two got sacked from the agency this morning, and the guy named Jez has gone for beer. Fair enough, I say. Well, first things first, I pull out the t-shirts and distribute them. You would think I was handing out I'm with stupid shirts. Oh my God, drones Hermione. These are hideous, says Faye One. And they're one size fits all, I answer, trying for cheeriness. Do we have to wear these, someone asks. Absolutely, I say, your boss insists. Well, I just don't think it's necessary, says Faye Two. Neither is advertising, I say, because frankly, I've already had enough. This invokes an immediate cold silence. Look, I say, if we're going to play like a team, we're going to look like a team, let's go. I heave the equipment bag onto my shoulder and head toward our assigned field. The snake biters straggle behind glumly like remoras trailing an old shark. They are gathered at my feet at the base of a towering plane tree, a somewhat biblical panorama. I toss a softball up and down, feeling its heft in my palm, a feeling that connects me to a million childhood memories. Skills, I have decided, will come later. First, I want to impart a reverence for the game itself. Base! Ball! Base! Ball! All right? There are 10 positions. Learn them. We observe the opposing batter. Is he left-handed or right-handed? This dictates in which direction he will likely hit the ball. We make adjustments in our positions. We stay aware at all times of the base runner. Is he standing on first? If so, we try to make the play to second. They all look around at each other, trying to make a joke of this with facial expressions. One young man rolls his eyes, runs his finger down the length of his tie, and makes it snap. I continue. The ball cracks off a tubular shaft of cold-rolled aluminum at a velocity exceeding 60 miles per hour. Common sense dictates that you dive out of the way. That is a natural response, but that is not the game of softball. You use a large padded mitt to stop it. You keep the mitt between your body and the ball at all times. That is what protects you. The alternative is severe bodily bruising, possibly even brain damage. Learn to trust your mitt. They're in shock and scared. Good, I've impacted. Softball, I explain, mellowing my approach, is quite simply about going home. I place the rubber pentagon, home plate, on the ground and put my toe to its edge. This is home. You can see it's even shaped somewhat like a house. In this respect, the game might be viewed as a sort of pastoral journey. A relieved murmur ripples through the crowd. If you want to appeal to Brits, invoke home. At the end of the day, Brits love to be home, snug and cozy, and drunk. Just as quickly, I lose them again. Naturally, this means we must not allow the other team to get home. Ah! As if I just said, kill the homeless. Hey, I say, your social opinions are without merit here. Christ, half of the world thinks you people are pansies when it's really only an issue of playing the right sport. Now I'm going to assign a lineup. Robotically, they stand up as one and arrange themselves into a queue. No, I say. A lineup is the players' positions. There are infielders, there are outfielders. The outfielder stops the ball that gets past the infielders. The infielders protect the bases. The infield is in the shape of a diamond. Then, in what can only be described as classic British truculence, I get this. Why? Why what? Why is it in the shape of a diamond? I can't begin to comprehend what's behind that question, I say. Well, certainly a triangle makes more sense. As one, the snake biters agree on this, as if it's been an oversight of baseball for the past 150 years. You know what I say? You're absolutely right, and as soon as I get back to the States, I will take that up with the commissioner of Major League Baseball. But for right now, let's just go with a diamond. Take me now, Jesus. I lay out the bases. They're too far away, complain the snake biters. Can we move them up a bit? Must I stand in front of the batter when I bowl? Surely it's safer to stand off to one side. And at one point, there was the following supremely withering exchange. All right, Barnaby, is it? Do you mind if I call you Barney? Please don't. Fine, Barnaby. You pitch. Do what? Pitch. Where on the pitch? Sorry? Where on the pitch do you want me? No, the pitch is not the field. The pitch is when you throw the ball. Oh, you mean bowling. Yeah, bowling, right. But it's called pitching. If the ball is over the plate, it's called a strike. If it's not over the plate, it's called a ball. Well, when is a ball not a ball? When it's a strike. It's only a ball if it's a wide pitch. I thought you said it was a field. Also, Sanjeev, it is not appropriate to stand in the outfield and run up to deliver a softball at supersonic speed. You must stand in one place and lob it underhanded. Then, an horrific display of fielding ineptness. I stand at home plate with the bat, throw the ball up, peppered in the general direction of the infielders. They collide into each other, a delirium of limbs moving in unnatural directions. They react with horror movie histrionics whether they catch it or not. Within 15 minutes, they have thoroughly lost interest. They stand around in a kind of rapture thinking about, well, not being here. By the tree behind home plate, the young man named Hamish is pressing himself against one of the fays, mashing into her face while extending his glove. Meanwhile, the right fielder, Julius, one of Pete's shit-hot copywriters, is on his mobile phone conducting a surreal conversation. All right, now delete the sentence that ends with enhanced flavoring. Delete Norwegian, replace with cold North Sea. Replace cold with icy. In the following phrase, delete inviolate territorial waters. A series of hard grounders passes unimpeded through his legs and cut the entire sea shanty except for the first two lines. Later, a ball is sent flying over his head where it rolls into some undergrowth. Julius goes to retrieve it and does not reappear, but eventually texts the pitcher to say he cannot find the ball. The 12th man, Jez, arrives with a crate of beer. Instantly, my formation dismantles and descends on him like a pack of coyotes. It was almost a scuffle to get at the beer. Out of nowhere, a group of Nigerian youths invade the outfield and take up an impromptu football game, swarming back and forth like aquarium fish. Hamish and Faye have slyly disappeared to the far side of the sycamore. All I can see is Faye's elbow near the base of the tree, moving back and forth in a kind of pneumatic way. It is springtime. And that is when I beamed the imam. It was an accident, of course. Smacking a Muslim holy man in the face with a softball is not the sort of thing they do in Britain. It happened right after one of the girls had discovered semen in a baseball glove, just when it seemed like things couldn't get worse. I only meant to hit a sharp line drive at the Nigerians as a way of moving them along, but the ball glanced off my bat and rocketed toward a park bench near the third baseline. The imam was sitting there minding his own business, no doubt lost in some impenetrable Islamic reverie. It caught him square in the nose, and he went over like a sack of flour. I ran over there to see if he was okay. To this day, I don't know why I didn't put the bat down beforehand. I just wasn't thinking. I had to push through a cluster of partgoers who had already gathered. The imam lay sprawled on the pavement, his great cloak fanning in all directions. He looked strangely docile. Blood was streaming from his nose, but his hands were at his chest, clasping the Quran as if it was some kind of jetpack that any second now might transport him skyward toward paradise. This was a very unnerving tableau, and if anyone had bothered to truly study the grainy camera phone photographs that would appear in Arab language newspapers the following day, they would have seen that the man with a baseball bat standing over him had a look of genuine concern on his face. The following day, Pete summons me to his agency in Charlotte Street. His office is on a stainless steel gallery overlooking the work floor. He's at the window waiting for me, his wide spread hands up against the glass. He looks like one of those tree frogs. I have to walk through the open plan work area where the snake biters avert their eyes, pretending not to see me. I'm going downhill fast. Pete opens the door for me and I follow him in. There's a man in a cafe seated beside the desk, his hands patiently folded in his lap. "This is Ibrahim," says Pete. "Ibrahim is with the Muslim League." For just a moment, this is confusing. Pete reads it on my face. "The Muslim League is not remotely interested in playing softball. Ibrahim is here to help mediate this unfortunate situation." I offer Ibrahim a handshake. He merely nods back at me. "You are gracious to have come," he says. I take a seat in one of those flimsy Danish chairs. It's just a chrome frame and leather strips and feels like an ass hammock. Pete looks pretty rattled. His mouth is just a restrained mark like a Peanuts character. "How's the imam?" I ask. Pete's eyes shoot toward Ibrahim for a response. Ibrahim informs me that the imam has lost 2 liters of blood and has been fitted with a protective face shield that he will have to wear for 2 months. "Al Jazeera led with it on this morning's broadcast," adds Pete, who's always right on top of the new media thing. "Please convey to the imam that I'm truly sorry," I say. "I will certainly do that," says Ibrahim, "but I feel it is more important that you convey those sentiments to the imam's followers." Pete shows me a couple of Arab language newspapers, my picture and an accompanying story. "What do these say?" I ask Ibrahim. "The stories say that the imam was a victim of an accident and was tended to by helpful passersby." "That's good," I say. "But," Pete says, "the picture says something entirely different. The picture shows a man with a bat attacking the imam." "We both know that's not what happened. Unfortunately, that is exactly as it appeared," said Pete. "This is the kind of picture that extreme elements of the Muslim community will exploit. They will sell it as an anti-Muslim experience. Isn't that right, Ibrahim?" Ibrahim nods slowly. "Perhaps," he says. "So what?" I say. "Is there going to be a fatwa on my head?" Ibrahim doesn't think this is funny. "That is a very naive statement," he says. "You seem to be confusing the Nation of Islam with the Mafia." I look out the window into Charlotte Street. It's a wonderful spring day, dampened only slightly by the sheer discomfort of this meeting. I point out that this whole thing could have been avoided if the Royal Parks had had the foresight not to put park benches down the third base line. "That's why it's called the hot corner," I add somewhat gratuitously. Silence. "Okay," I say, "how do I apologize?" "It is not possible to apologize," says Ibrahim. "What's done is done." And it's moments like these when I'm accused of setting off the Third Crusade that I tend to get a little defiant. "What do you want from me then?" I bark. "It was an accident. You act like I rubbed a damn softball in pork before I hit him." There was another frigid silence, after which Pete remarks, "I'm fairly sure that was unnecessary." "Perhaps," says Ibrahim, "you need to explain to the Muslim community how the game is played. Then they would understand how this accident occurred. You want me to explain to 1 billion people how softball is played? I can't even explain it to those 11 piss heads downstairs." Pete looks disoriented. "You must calm down," says Ibrahim. "We are trying to bring unity between Muslim and Christian communities. That is our sole aim." "Unity," I say. "By the way, Pete, I'm done coaching your team. A decent third baseman would have snagged that ball." "What if you just explained the nature of the game?" Pete offered. "What you told my players." "I don't remember," I said. "I was hungover. You know, about going home. You said softball was about going home." "Yeah," I say, "I told them that. I should have gone straight to the rules instead of some soppy analogy." "It is an excellent analogy," said Ibrahim. He stood up to give his next words magisterial weight. "Many of the world's problems would cease to exist," he said, "if Americans would simply go home." The last-minute ticket from Heathrow to JFK cost me a fortune. I actually cracked a joke about it to the guy wedged into the seat beside me. "They charged an arm and a leg, and there's still not enough room," I said cheerfully. It was a crap joke, but at least I was getting my sense of humor back. I already had a stiff Bloody Mary on the tray in front of me. We hadn't even pulled back from the runway yet. That's wrong. Toward the runway. The seatmate, my seatmate, a large black man in a matching golf cap and sweater from a St. Andrews pro shop, reacted with a look so surly I actually found myself checking to make sure he wasn't minus an extremity or two. I just needed this bad luck streak of miscues to be over, and it wasn't until the plane was over North America and I looked down at the patchwork of baseball diamonds cropping up from the outreaches of Long Island that I could truly feel anything like euphoria. Thank you.